Welcome to Acre Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and this podcast is with Kurt Schroeder. Kurt was a former US Navy F-4 and F-8 fighter pilot. He eventually became the chief test pilot for Grumman, testing and developing the F-14 Tomcat. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/Acre Interview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. Also visit us at acreinterview.tv to watch all of our other interviews and sign up to our newsletter. Thank you and enjoy. So could you give us a bit of background about your flying career?
Sure. When I graduated from high school, I applied for a Navy scholarship, ROTC scholarship, which I was awarded to go to the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It was a program, NRTC, that ended up at graduation, you were given a regular commission in the United States Navy. Mm-hmm. So during that program, they expose you to different aspects of the Navy. And one of them, of course, was aviation. Mm-hmm. on a summer cruise.
Yeah.
And I was hooked. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that's what I really wanted to do. Unfortunately, they extended the obligation of active duty after graduation from 3.5 years to 5 years.
Okay.
And I had worked very hard to get a degree in mechanical engineering, and people told me if you if you spend 5 years in the military, you'll be so far behind in the corporate world, behind your contemporaries, that you'll never catch up. So I decided that I would forego aviation and went and was on a destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the task of the destroyer was to chase the carrier around, and I observed all the airplanes, and I said, the hell with it. I want to do it. And so I requested, and the skipper approved it for me to go to flight training. So that's how I got involved in it. Mm-hmm. The first day of flight training, they ask everybody in the audience, how many people want to fly jets? And, of course, everybody raises their hand.
Yeah.
And they said, well, look at the person on either side of you, because he won't be there if you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to, standing in class and what have you, that I got my choice.
Mm-hmm.
Going to fighters. And so my initial assignment was to the F-8 Crusader, which was the current Navy fighter at the time.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And what have you. I spent a little more than a cruise in Crusaders, and then the squadron transitioned to F-4s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spent the rest of the time on active duty in F-4s. And then I was selected to go to the Navy Test Pilot School, where I had the pleasure of working with both the F-8 and the F-4.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I had, in the interim, gotten married and had a couple kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that to leave the Navy, and Grumman was looking for someone to work with them on the F-14 program. So that happened to me in 1972, and the F-14 at that time was in its infancy.
So what was your initial role joining Grumman and working with the F-14?
I was hired as an experimental test pilot, and the various programs, there are different aspects on when a brand new airplane's been developed. What I ended up doing was given the responsibility for the carrier suitability.
Mm-hmm.
Effort on the airplane, which from a contractor standpoint is essentially going to a Navy facility and demonstrating that the design strength, the strength in the airplane, was adequate for the carrier-based task.
Mm-hmm. So what was the Navy considering to be the principal threat to the carrier at this time?
The threat that was evolving was the introduction of air-launched to surface missiles, and these were, of course, the perceived threat was the Soviet Union, and they had large bombers that carried multiple missiles. And these missiles were very, very high speed, supersonic missiles, and so dealing with the threat mm-hmm. is that the Navy decided that what they needed was to kill the bomber mm-hmm. before he launched the missiles. Mm-hmm. And to do that, it meant that you had to have an airplane that would go a long distance out range-wise, mm-hmm. would be able to loiter on a cap station for a long time, and then have the ability to target and kill the bomber before he released the missiles. Mm-hmm. In conjunction with that, since there were always the threat of multiple bombers, the Navy wanted an airplane that could not only detect but track an airplane, a bomber-sized target, at long range, and had a missile that they could launch, and it would essentially, the radar in the fighter airplane mm-hmm. would guide the missile, but it could do it to more than one target simultaneously. And the F-14 had the ability to do that at six different targets, mm-hmm. which was considerably different than what the existing airplanes could do, which was only to designate and track one target.
So what did the U.S. Navy fighter community actually want in this new jet?
Well, the fighter community wanted an airplane optimized for the fighter mission. Mm-hmm. And by that we mean the maneuverability was an obvious one, performance of the airplane, other things like field of view mm-hmm. so that you can see out of the cockpit to see the threat, and an internal gun. Mm-hmm. All of these things were things they'd been living without in the F-4. Mm-hmm. The F-4 was designed for a little bit different mission. So they were adamant about this time around, they wanted an airplane optimized for the air-to-air dogfight mission.
So the F-14 was strictly air-to-air at this point?
The F-14 from the get-go was a multi-mission design mm-hmm. for air-to-air and air-to-ground. Mm-hmm. And the what happened as the fleet was involved in the development of the airplane, mm-hmm. the fighter community was not interested in any of the air-to-ground capability. Mm-hmm. The times that was all the threat was air-to-air. There wasn't a whole lot of ground attack activity going on at that time. Mm-hmm. And so they decided they weren't going to spend any money or add any weight to the airplane for air to ground. They wanted it optimized for air to air.
So initially the Navy actually wanted the F-111B, if I'm correctly saying. And what went wrong with this?
Well, the F-111B, and we've been guilty of it since, is that somebody decided the way to reduce costs was to have a common airplane for all the services. Mm-hmm. And that would, in order for that to be true, then you'd have to believe that the requirements for the carrier-based naval aviation, the Marine Corps, sometimes land-based close air support mission, mm-hmm. and the Air Force's mission in their thing, that one airplane could do it all. Mm-hmm. And that evolved into the F-111. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be somewhat of a disaster from the Navy standpoint. Mm-hmm. It's that the airplane that resulted was extremely heavy. It had very poor maneuverability. Mm-hmm. It didn't have any of the aspects that the fighter community was looking for. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be not suitable for the carrier-based task. Mm-hmm. The Air Force eventually evolved the airplane into a long-range strike airplane, but it's a completely different mission.
So was the F-14 an actual design coming from the failure of the F-111, or was it already in design while these tests were going on?
Well, it became obvious F-111 was not going to be suitable for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And Grumman basically incorporated some items from the 111, most notably the radar, the long-range radar, and the long-range missile, the Phoenix missile. Mm-hmm. And but then they, in regards to that, they went ahead and said, okay, but we're going to satisfy the other requirements as far as the dogfight or the fighter role. Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine Grumman had a lot of design challenges. Could you name a few for us and what they actually went through?
Well, basically it was to put these capabilities into a single airframe. Mm-hmm. And the technology at the time, the F-14 utilized all the available technology, but there were things that today make everything a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Probably the best example is the advent of the digital computer.
Yes.
Back then, computers were in existence, but they were analog computers.
Yeah.
And digital computers were not considered mature enough to be incorporated into a design. Mm-hmm. So the F-14 utilized small analog computers, mm-hmm. but they were located throughout the airplane, and depending on what their function was. Mm-hmm. Whereas in today's design, they have everything is centralized into a digital computer, mm-hmm. and everything controlled from one source. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the issues. And then the Navy wanted an airplane that would go to 800 knots, which is a very high speed at low altitude.
Very, yeah.
And it wanted a Mach number of 2.4 Mach number. Those were the requirements, mm-hmm. for the airplane. But then because it has to operate off the carrier, they wanted a carrier approach speed of about 120 knots.
Wow.
Which was a good 20 knots below, 20 to 25 knots below what the current airplane, the F-4, was doing.
Yeah.
So how do you get an airplane that's capable of that envelope? And how do you get the maneuverability? And that's where the variable sweep wing came in. And although the F-111 had a variable sweep wing, it was manually controlled. Mm-hmm. In the F-14, it was decided that it would be computer controlled. The pilot can intercede, but basically it was automatically controlled. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the design of the F-14, the wings are located out. I actually have a model here that let me see if I can get it into your field of view.
There we go, just a bit higher. There we go.
So you'll see here is that the wings, there's a wide fuselage, mm-hmm. that the wings are positioned out here. And what that does, unlike the F-111, is that there are no ordnance or anything carried on the wings of the F-14. Mm-hmm. All the ordnance is carried in the tunnel underneath, mm-hmm. or on what we call the glove area, which is here, mm-hmm. which is not part of the wing sweep. Mm-hmm. So it made the aerodynamic efficiency of the airplane considerably better. Mm-hmm. The other challenge that the Navy always faces is how do you reduce the size of the airplane when it's on the carrier deck? Mm-hmm. And Grumman achieved that by incorporating in the wing sweep is a function called oversweep. Mm-hmm. You could sweep the wings past the normal in-flight position, and it would put the wingtips inside the horizontal tail.
Oh, okay.
So reduce the size of the airplane. Basically, there were things that were unique to the fighter community at that time. Mm-hmm. Head-up display, which is very common in airplanes today,
yes.
was a brand new concept at that time, and so there was a big learning curve with the HUD, the head-up display, mm-hmm. in the F-14. The other thing is that the Navy wanted something with long range, mm-hmm. and not only long range, but good loiter capability. And so it had to carry a lot of fuel. Mm-hmm. And a common solution to more fuel is to hang external tanks on an airplane. Most airplanes that I can think of give up a store station in order to carry an external tank.
Yeah.
The F-14 did not. It carried the external tanks on the engine nacelle, and so it was not a store station. So that was advantageous. The other thing that they went to with it is everybody was looking for more thrust.
Yes.
And the way to thrust at that time was turbofan engines to have a high bypass ratio, which had the advantage of being able to develop more thrust, but also was more economical as far as in flight, and as far as fuel efficiency. The challenge there was that when you made an afterburner to a fan engine, it created all sorts of new problems. And
yeah.
Once again, go back to the non-existence of digital computers at the time, the fuel controls were all manual.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, when the afterburner would be used to either to be lit off or shut down, it would send a pressure spike up the fan duct and cause the engine to stall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the F-30, which is the engine that was in the F-111, was known to have very poor, what we would call operability,
mm-hmm.
very poor stalling, what have you. The Navy intent was that wasn't the engine intended for the F-14.
Yes.
There was, Pratt & Whitney was developing an engine designated the 401, which was a higher thrust engine and modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the F-14 was designed around the 401 engine
mm-hmm.
with its thrust levels. Well, unfortunately, as that engine ran into a huge developmental problems.
Sorry, carry on.
huge developmental problems to the point that the Navy gave up on it and canceled the program.
Mm-hmm.
So the Navy, which had opted to use the TF-30 to get the initial development airplanes flying, but only to do that the first 31 airplanes.
Yeah.
And from then on, it would have the big engine. Well, the big engine went away, and the TF-30 became the production engine for the fleet. And the engine ended up driving almost everything in the airplane, the way the pilots were required to fly it, to operate it, to avoid the engine stalls. And a fighter engine, you don't want to have to deal with that, but that was necessity.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, how did the pilots actually react to having the TF-30? Did they initially really dislike it, or did they like it?
Well, they loved the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and the engine it was the only option in town. So they learned, a typical way to describe it was they learned to fly the engine,
mm-hmm.
which is not the way it's not what you want.
Yeah.
And as a result of it, the TF-30 we had in development, it was always a challenge because the engine would stall. And it was generally a problem in maneuvering flight, but also when you're trying to expand the Mach number and going to higher Mach numbers,
mm-hmm.
the engine stalls were a real problem.
So what was the real actual speed with the TF-30 engine? What was the maximum you could reach in the aircraft?
Well, the design goal or the design requirement for the engine for the airplane was 2.4 Mach number, and we got there.
Okay.
The maximum Mach that we got the airplane to was 2.41, a little bit over that.
Wow.
But then the Navy decided that because of the engine possibility, the engine stalling out there, that there were some structural
mm-hmm.
Changes that would have to be made to the inlet to counter that, to accept the loads of an engine stall. And the Navy said, we don't need that. And they just really reduced the speed envelope on paper to 2.0.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much how it lived for the rest of it, they felt that the difference was not an operational necessity.
So just backtracking a bit, I remember the early F-14s had, and I'm not sure what they're called here, is it the front canards, what used to be retractable? What happened to those?
Okay, I can show those to you. I think they're on here. Yeah.
Yeah, there they are.
You can see these, and they're called glove vanes.
Glove vanes, yes.
And what they are is an aerodynamic surface that was extended, either could be controlled by the pilot, but would also be controlled by the computer that controlled the wing sweep. Mm-hmm. And the value of them is, because of their location forward on the airplane, is they destabilize the airplane. Talking about that is that stability, which everybody wants to have or needs to have in an airplane, is the enemy of maneuverability. Mm-hmm. And the obvious why that is because in order to maneuver an airplane, you have to overcome the basic stability that wants to resist it. Mm-hmm. So the glove vanes were destabilizing supersonically, which, because of the center of pressure on the wing that moves when you go supersonic, airplanes gain stability as they get supersonic.
Yeah.
And so the supersonic maneuverability of airplanes is restricted because of this increased stability. Well, the glove vanes reduce that. It had large aerodynamic benefits. But like everything else in the service of it, the Navy decided that the weight, but more the maintainability aspects of having additional surfaces on the on the airplane were not justified, and they ended up eliminating them on the later airplanes.
Yes, yes.
It was unfortunate because it was a very useful surface.
Yeah. So moving on, could you go over some development highlight points for us?
Yeah, I think, basically the first thing that in the flight test program is all the fighter airplanes, at least the ones I'm familiar with, the Crusader and the Phantom, mm-hmm. when you decelerated and slowed down with the airplane and increased the angle of attack, that's the angle of the call it the wind, if you will, the air to the wing, mm-hmm. you'd reach a point where if you went any further, you'd lose control of the airplane. The wing would separate, it would roll off, and potentially it could go into uncontrolled flight.
Wow.
So the question was, where was this with the F-14? And so when the flight test program started looking at the high angle of attack characteristics and decelerating, lo and behold, is you could go all the way to full aft stick on the airplane, and the airplane wouldn't roll up. It just would be very controllable. Oh. And the reason for that was kind of explained a little bit later when we got into the structural program, because when you start to expand the structural envelope of the airplane, typically one of the limits you reach is what's called wing bending. Mm-hmm. It's a structural thing in that the wings assume, as you go to higher and higher loads, the wings accept more and more load and eventually reach the strength of the wing. Mm-hmm. It would be a limitation, obviously. So on the F-14, when we got into that program, lo and behold, that as the maneuvering load was increased, suddenly the wing load started to decrease, mm-hmm. which is certainly much to everybody's surprise, because the airplane did not exhibit any nonlinearity. It was still maneuvering. Mm-hmm. And what it turned out was that the wings would start relieving because of the exceeding the angle of attack, but the aerodynamic load, the lifting, was transferred to the center body of the mm-hmm. airplane.
Yeah.
And that was a big benefit of the wide-spaced engines, is that it actually became like a lifting body.
Yeah.
So basically what had happened is that the airplane really was nearly bulletproof as far as symmetrical G and load on it.
Yeah. So I was going to say, with them all, when it was loaded up with Phoenix missiles, would that affect the lift at all?
No, the Phoenix is a large missile. It weighs 1,000 pounds, and the airplane was designed to carry six of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, four of those were carried on pallets in the tunnel, which is the area that we were discussing. Two of them were carried, could be carried on the glove pylons.
Mm-hmm.
But the Phoenix or any kind of store in the tunnel really didn't affect the maneuvering capability of the airplane. And so what you start to think about it too is that when you start to maneuver the airplane and fire and rolling the airplane and everything else, the closer to the center of the airplane that the heavy stores are,
yeah,
the less effect it has. And so we got big benefits,
mm-hmm,
out of that, mm-hmm, as well.
So it must have been very structurally safe and very strong.
It was. The only limitation that really came into the airplane is that on the F-14, when you roll the airplane, control it laterally, when the wings are forward of somewhat forward, we have spoilers on the wings which are used for lateral control. But then as you got the higher speeds and the wings came back, the spoilers were deactivated, and then all of the rolling moment of the airplane is created by the tails, the vertical or the horizontal tails of the airplane,
mm-hmm,
these back here.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine this in the aft fuselage of the airplane, when you're maneuvering symmetrically, you put bending load into the aft fuselage of the airplane. But when you're rolling the airplane, you put a torque on it in order to roll the airplane. So basically, if it could handle without any problem as far as the rolling torque or the symmetrical torque. But if you exceeded the design limitation of the airplane of putting a lot of bending on it and then put the torsion in, that's where people had to watch what they were doing and stay within the limits of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a characteristic that in today's world would be real easy with a fly-by-wire control system, because that way the flight control computers know exactly what's going on, and it would prevent that from happening. I should back up a little bit. Is the flight control system on the F-14 is hydromechanical.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that the control surfaces, with the exception of the spoilers, the control surfaces are responded to by physical movement of either the stick or the rudder,
mm-hmm,
by the pilot. And in modern airplanes with the fly-by-wire control systems, there is no mechanical connection.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what that allows you to do from a central computer is it could send commands to surfaces, whatever would be appropriate to tailor for that particular moment. So the fact that the F-14 did all of this with mechanical, essentially hydraulic, but mechanical control surfaces, mm-hmm, that the maneuvering capability of F-14 was done aerodynamically,
mm-hmm,
whereas in a modern airplane with a fly-by-wire control system, is because they have complete control of,
yeah,
all the surfaces, they can overcome a lot of aerodynamic design flaws in order to protect the airplane.
So how well did the auto sweep work? Did it work every time? Was it reliable?
It was very reliable, and not surprisingly, the first thing that came up was, well, what do you do if the wing sweep failed?
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually had a test program where we intentionally failed the wing on one side and to see whether the airplane, and it made for great pictures because there's pictures of the airplane with one wing forward and the one,
yeah,
one all the way back, and the airplane's still flying,
yeah,
which it was. And you had enough control power that you could literally come back and land on a field. Now, you wouldn't want to go back to the ship in that configuration.
No.
But anyway, so the results, you could say, were very, very positive. But in the entire length life of the airplane, I don't recall a single asymmetric wing sweep failure. They just, it was very, very reliable, and it worked as advertised.
So how much development in terms of years before it was introduced to the fleet?
Well, that's, if you compare it against current programs, that it's remarkably different. The airplane, first flight of the airplane occurred in the late 1970s, December 1970, and the first airplanes went to the fleet 4 years later.
That's very fast for a complicated aircraft.
Well, and by today's standards, it's blazing speed.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, the current airplanes, well, the current one has been in development for, what, 20 years? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, that's another point that the F-14 was a forerunner in it, is years ago, Grumman made airplanes for the U.S. Navy during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, when they were flight testing those airplanes, the pilot went out and would do a maneuver. This is trying to determine the structural strength.
Mm-hmm.
He would do a maneuver. He would write whatever he wanted on his kneeboard. And then the proof of the pudding was he'd go back and land, and they'd inspect the airplane mm-hmm. to see if it had caused any damage. Well, this is very time-consuming and imprecise, if you will. So the next thing that happened is they started to install onboard recording instruments for the instrumentation on the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Pilot would go out and he'd do a maneuver, and with the recorder on, then he'd come back and land, and they'd take the recorder out of the airplane, dump the data out, and decide whether they could go to the next point, because all a flight test is basically step increments. You clear it to a point, you analyze the data, and then you say, okay, we can go further, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that obviously is, once again, time consuming. So the next iteration is said, well, why don't we take this data that's being recorded and transmit it down to the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, the engineers can see it right after the maneuver is complete.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that, and the data would come down, and it would be in the increments of whatever the instrumentation had.
Mm-hmm.
The engineers in the ground station would have to copy those down, go to their graph or their plot, and plot that and say, okay, it's following predictions, or it's higher or lower, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So F-14 program got started. Grumman came up with what is called the automated telemetry station.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did is the same thing. As the airplane was heavily instrumented, all the instrumentation was transmitting the data down to the ground. But now it was entered into the computer. The computer would have the program, the software, in order to convert it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the flight test engineer is looking at on the computer a graph of exactly where that new plot lies in relation to the predictions.
Yeah.
So it just speeds the whole process up. And so when you're out there and you're particularly doing supersonic work, you're consuming a lot of fuel. So
yeah.
time is important. And so that allowed the expediting of the flight test program tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the other thing that we took advantage of was in-flight refueling. We had our own A6 tankers
mm-hmm.
that would go out with the project airplane, and then rather than having to come back and refuel and go back out, the project airplane would take on, for instance, in supersonic work, it would take on more fuel and continue the program.
Yeah.
That's really what truncated the flight test program.
Yeah. So when it was on board and part of the fleet, a lot of aircraft started being retired, such as the F-8 and the A-5 and their reconnaissance role. Could you tell us a bit about how the F-14 filled this?
Well, that was a, as you stated, is that the Fleet Air Reconnaissance, which is a photo airplane that would go out and would photograph potential targets or for bomb damage assessment, was performed by the photo FA. And then as it got older and older, the Navy introduced the RA-5C, which was a conversion from the A-5A, which never really had much of a use. And it was a very effective one, but then it got retired. And so now the question, who's going to do the job? And the job fell on the F-14. They designed a pod, a reconnaissance pod, that could be carried on the airplane. And so the F-14 became, it's called a TARPS pod, Tactical Air Reconnaissance Pod. And that became the photo information for the fleet. And they developed that to the point in the latter stages of it, they actually could transmit that data back to the ship, so they would get it before before the airplane ever came back to the ship.
So how well did the F-14 fill that role?
Well, it had everything that you wanted in a photo airplane. Everybody that has ever done the photo mission, speed is of the essence.
Yeah.
The faster the better, because you're going into high threat areas and speed is typically your only defense. The F-14 had the speed.
Yeah.
F-14 had the range. If required, the F-14 had the endurance to stay in a target area. And it had a self-protection capability. So if it was being harassed by enemy fighters, it could fight back. An example of its predecessor, the RA-5C, had no air-to-air capability. So fighters, the only way it could combat the fighters was with speed. So the F-14 had everything they were looking for. Plus, the F-14, it didn't really affect the handling speed capability of the airplane, so it was very effective.
So did was there certain F-14 squadrons that just fulfilled their photo reconnaissance role, or did they have to do everything air to air, air to ground as well?
Well, what they did is they initially, the normal air wing, that's the complement of airplanes on the carrier deck, would have two F-14 squadrons. So they didn't want to have to procure pods for all the F-14s because it was a specified mission.
Yeah.
So they would designate one of the two squadrons to have that capability, and then they would have a limited number of airplanes that were configured to carry this pod. And so now to show you the value of it is the later modification of the F-14, which was the F-14D, they chose to modify the wiring in all the airplanes. So they put a top spot on any of the airplanes. So that just shows you the tactical value of it.
Yeah. And then in 1987, I think the F-14 had a massive upgrade with the F-110 engines. Could you tell us about this?
Well, let me just step back a little bit to the TF-30. Because the TF-30 had many, many problems. And the significant problem was in maneuvering flight is that a typical dogfight is the pilot would like the ability to select afterburner, come out of afterburner, move the engine to idle, to max power, what have you. The TF-30 didn't like any of that, and it had a tendency to stall there. Well, if a TF-30 airplane is in maneuvering flight and he's in full afterburner and an engine stalls, the first thing that happens is the afterburner will blow out. The thrust coming out of that engine goes to very low levels. And because it's not producing thrust anymore. And in the F-14, because the engines are spaced apart, it provides an asymmetric yawing moment on the airplane. which is if left unattended, can cause the airplane to depart.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, well, okay, step one, if you get into that situation, is you would like to take the other engine out of afterburner,
mm-hmm.
to remove the asymmetric thrust,
mm-hmm.
right? You can't do that because if you do, that engine is likely to stall.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're down to no engines.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the procedure was, if you had an engine stall at that point, that you would leave the other engine where it is, which mm-hmm. could be in low afterburner. This complicated the recovery process of the airplane. So basically, but we had no other choice, because the engine, if it did stall and you didn't address it,
mm-hmm.
it would damage the engine and you might be out of engines.
Mm-hmm.
So when the F-110 came, F-110 had what we call compatibility everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and you had unlimited use of the throttle. You could go from idle to max AB, back, forth, what have you. The engine had no problem whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the first thing that came to our mind with the F-110 was, we can modify the out of control recovery procedures.
Mm-hmm.
At step one is bring both engines to idle. In other words, you take the pilot out of the requirement to identify which engine stalled, what does he have to do, and everything else. You don't question, pull them both back to idle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Navy said, Nav Air, which controls it, says, well, you can't change it if we don't flight test it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, okay, so we will go out and we will flight test this. And in order to do that, you got to go out and intentionally depart the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Well, historically, anytime you're doing that kind of a program called a high alpha program, they required that you had spin recovery devices, so mm-hmm. spin chute, airplane, and other items. There wasn't any money. There wasn't a F-110 airplane configured with these devices.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, we think we can do it with our development airplane, aircraft number 7,
mm-hmm.
and we can do it safely. We can go out, we can intentionally depart the airplane, and then we can institute these recovery procedures and make sure the F-110 behaves itself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that program, which I had the pleasure of flying, it was marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
What we did with that airplane was incredible. And so as final, at the end of the program, we said, what can we possibly do to stress the engine any more than we have? And so we decided we would try to do a maneuver where we got the airplane in a tail slide above 40,000 feet, around 45,000 feet. And so with the airplane sliding backwards at 45,000 feet, we cycled the engine from idle to max AB and back to idle, and it didn't miss a beat.
Wow.
So it's a marvelous engine. Well, having mentioned that, the obvious thing from a fighter pilot standpoint was the increased thrust of the F-110. It was dramatically increased the thrust. And it allowed the Navy, from the standpoint, for instance, catapult launch. The TF-30 airplane, when it had a gross weight that it was normally launched off the ship, would normally go on afterburner. Why? Because right after carrier launch, if you lose an engine, you needed enough thrust to be able to fly away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the F-110 has got enough thrust that in basic engine, so they could launch the airplane in basic engine rather than afterburner, which is a big fuel saver, because you're not required to use the afterburner for launch. So the F-110 made the airplane a different airplane. It was loved by everybody that flew it. The only people that are unhappy are F-14 pilots that left the community the F-110 arrived.
And then in 1990, the F-14D was introduced. Could you tell us a bit about the improvements on this model?
Well, the F-14, weapon system-wise, had essentially, from the early 70s when the airplane was developed, until then had really no significant upgrades to the weapon system. The threat, as everyone knows, increases. Capabilities that you like to have increase and what have you. So there was a plan to replace the radar, the AUG-9, which is essentially an analog radar. They went with an APG-71, which is a digital radar, much more capable. Cockpit displays were changed. A lot of subtle little things inside the airplane in the cockpit. Unfortunately, as always, there were fiscal constraints on the upgrade. Whereas, I'll use as an example, when the Air Force decided they wanted to make an attack airplane out of the F-15C, which is a fighter, and they wanted to make the E, which is a ground attack airplane, they essentially gutted the airplane and put all brand new stuff in it. Well, the F-14 going from the A and the B to the D wasn't the fiscal constraints were much stricter. So they did put things in to give it the capability, but it was much more of a patchwork kind of thing. But the evolution of the F-14 initially was fleet air defense, and that's really what the Navy used it for. Then Desert Storm came along, and Desert Storm was all about ground attack. And Desert Storm was the first introduction of smart weapons. And we all know what smart weapons are. And so if you can only carry dumb weapons, nobody wants you anymore because they're never sure you're going to put the bombs where you're going to have them. So the F-14 guys started to think a little differently about, hey, we're out here for combat air patrol and what have you, but we're really not getting into the action, so to speak. And the solution was to put a smart weapon capability on the F-14. And the fleet did it pretty much by themselves. They installed a pod on the airplane, which was a laser targeting pod called Lantern. It was an Air Force pod. It existed already. They integrated it into the F-14, which gave them the ability to drop laser-guided weapons. And that transformed the whole mission of the airplane, because here now you had an airplane that, number one, could carry very large weapons. The airplane can carry 2,000-pound bombs, which are about as big as they have. It can carry four of them in the tunnel. It can carry a greater number of 1,000-pound bombs, or even 500-pound bombs. And it has a second person in the airplane that can run the targeting and what have you. So it's a point of choice in later conflicts, because it could stay there. It could stay there longer. It normally had bigger weapons, more of them, and had a second person in there to run the whole show in the back seat. And once again, the range and the payload of the F-14 paid off, because that was the other aspect of it. Back in the design stage, what the Navy was facing then is ground attack airplanes and, well, carrier launched airplanes. If they didn't expend the ordnance that they went off the front end with, typically they weren't authorized to bring it back because of the structural concerns. So they had a jettison it if they didn't expend it on the mission. Well, the Navy put a requirement on the F-14, said anything you go off the front end with, you have to have the capability of bringing it back. And so that was a big requirement. And so basically, once again, when you get into areas that where you have certain ordnance going off the front end, and for instance, Phoenix, you obviously don't want to jettison a Phoenix because it's too heavy to bring back aboard. And the same is true for the smart weapons. And so the F-14 was able to launch with these things. If it didn't expend it, it was able to bring them back.
So it was trusted on the from the ground guys that the F-14 was capable of doing the air-to-ground role.
Well, they love the F-14. I mean, if obviously they didn't have the capability to dictate what airplane was supporting them.
Yeah.
But they're always pleased to hear there was an F-14 because of the factors that I just mentioned to you. Some of the pictures I sent you was taken during what was called the pre-deployment update for the F-14D. But you'll notice on that airplane that in the tunnel were four Mark 84s, which are 2,000-pound bombs. Mm. And the performance of the airplane was remarkable with the weapons on board. It just, it is because it's a big airplane with the F-110s, it's not hurting for thrust, and so it really is a ideal situation for both the air-to-ground and air-to-air role.
So did the F-14 have more capability to carry more ordnance than the F-14A or B, even for that matter?
Well, the type of ordnance that, you know, basically that the airplane was designed to carry Mark 84s in the tunnel, and anything less than that. The airplane was designed to carry Phoenix out on the glove pylon, which is a 1,000-pound missile. It was also out there, you can carry AIM-9, Sidewinders, and Sparrow missiles, and any kind of a mixture of those, depending on what the mission requirements are. And you'll notice in that picture, you may notice, is the airplane has HAARM missiles on the pylons. They wanted to investigate that, and so we cleared HAARM on the airplane to the limits that the missile manufacturer allowed. But then the software never really got into the airplane and decided they didn't have the money to do that. So you'll never see an operational F-14 with a HAARM on it. But I remember during that program, the performance of the airplane was so impressive that we would get out to the carriage limits of the HAARM, and we'd be at partial power. And so we contacted the manufacturer and said, well, we can carry the HAARM faster than what you're clearing it to. What constitutes the carriage limit? And the answer was, we've never had a platform that could achieve the speed that we cleared it to.
Yeah.
So it was really impressive.
Because what was carrying, what aircraft was carrying them? Was it the F-4, maybe the F-16 at that time?
The Navy would put it on their attack airplanes.
Okay,
you know, right. I'm sure the F-18 carried it and what have you. So it was... The interesting thing is the HAARM is the effective range of the HAARM is not its ability to receive a signal. In other words, if a radar is emitting, it can see the radar from a long way out. But can it get there? Well, it has a rocket motor in it, but does it have the range? Well, that range is impacted by how fast are you and how high are you when you launch it. And of course the F-14 could have beat anybody else as far as being high and fast, and it would have increased the effective range of the HAARM.
So then in 1990, I think the Navy wanted to buy more F-14Ds, but they were refused by the Defense Department. Is this true?
Yes. Basically, there's a lot of stories out there exactly what happened. I think it's accurate to say that if the Navy had been able to act unilaterally, in other words, they requested more F-14Ds. There was a feeling within the Department of Defense, and how much of it was political, I won't get into that, but the decision was that the Navy was going to save all sorts of money by just going with F-18s and cancel any future production of the F-14. I think there's a lot of people that regret that decision, but nevertheless, what people have to understand is once an airplane comes out of production, it's never going to go back into production.
Of course, yeah. But it seemed by the time it was retired in 2006, it was at the top of its game, so it seems such a shame.
I think most people will admit that of all the airplanes in the airway, which one is the most effective? And I think most people would look for the F-14.
Yeah, and it's beautiful as well.
Yeah.
So just going back to a bit about your career, you were actually the chief test pilot until, is it 1995?
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit about that? What your actual role was?
Well, I joined the company as an experimental test pilot. We had different categories, and all that meant was that you were authorized to do envelope expansion with the airplane, what have you. I had been sent out to California to work with the weapons system out there at Point Magoo, and our chief test pilot at the time was Chuck Sewell, and he unfortunately lost his life in a vintage airplane. He was flying an airplane that was a World War II Navy airplane. So when they were out of chief test pilots at that point, and so they offered me the opportunity to come back to New York and become the chief test pilot, and then from there I ended up having the whole flight test thing, and then we had. Was the important part of it. I think the most rewarding thing is working with the fleet. These are the guys that are out there with your product.
Yeah.
And sometimes they will encounter things that nobody else had thought about and what have you. And so I'd like to think that Grumman was very, very responsive to fleet inputs when the fleet had a problem or they wanted a modification, Grumman would do to the best of their, within the constraints of having the funding and what have you, to make the modifications that the fleet was looking for.
Sounds like you had a great career with Grumman then.
Grumman was a unique aerospace company, mainly because it was non-union. And typically, all the large manufacturers, even today, are union shops. And what does that mean? It means that there were numerous attempts by the union to come into Grumman. And the management was smart enough to keep the employees very, very happy. And therefore, they wanted no part of the union. And the benefit of that is that typically, when we would take an airplane on the road for a project, that we would have a relatively small crew, because our electricians would, if we had an engine change, they'd be down there working with the engine people. And everybody was pitched in when anything needed to be done. I had a short exposure to the union environment while I was still in the Navy, because I was flying a airplane supported by, at that time, McDonnell Douglas, and I found there that the union rules were such that even small things like putting a ladder up on the side of the airplane for the crew to get in and out, if you were not a designated plane captain, or say you were an electrician, you couldn't do that, or you suffered consequences if you did, because you violated the union rules. So, not a way to run a business, in my mind.
No. So, did you have any scary moments or memorable moments while being a test pilot? I'm sure you probably did, but too many to talk about.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you are so involved in what's going on and what's happening. You don't really have time to think about that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you gain a real sense of confidence in the competency of the people you're working with. I had probably a good example was after when I joined the company, one of the times is we had made a small change to the flight control system in the longitudinal axis. And so before they would authorize the change, we had approved that it had no adverse consequences. Mm-hmm. So in the brief for the airplane, for the flight, they said, okay, this point we would like you to go out to 800 knots at 5,000 feet. And the airplanes I'd flown previously, the F-4 and the F-8, both had very high speed capability. Mm-hmm. But when you got out there, you wanted to be very careful with the airplane. Particularly in the longitudinal axis, is that you don't initiate what is called a pilot-induced oscillation, where the airplane starts to porpoise. Mm-hmm. The bad things are going to happen there. So I'm saying to myself, well, when I get out to 800 knots, I'm going to certainly I'm not going to do anything with the airplane. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to put small inputs in and what have you. Well, the previous airplanes, the F-8 and the F-4, as the F-14 has, they have stability augmentation systems, which are limited authority to stabilize the airplane. And you would never go out to those speeds in either the F-4 or the F-8 without that stability augmentation system working. Mm-hmm. So on the F-14, okay, so I'm out to 800 knots. What's next? They said, reach over and turn the pitch augmentation off. Thinking, you've got to be kidding me. Said, well, you sure about that? Yeah, you'll be fine. So I said, okay, after I've done that, now what do you want me to do? They said, give the stick a rap. Mm-hmm. And what it means is, with your fist, is to hit the stick to induce an oscillation. Mm-hmm. And see that the airplane damps it out. Well, I thought they were kidding me. I said, you don't want me to do that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I said, you'll be fine. And lo and behold, the airplane, very highly damped, not a problem.
Wow. Now,
that same thing, well, there's a video of the initial high speed testing of the F-4 where the airplane went into a PIO and destructed. Mm. And so, I mean, it's a very dangerous environment, but the F-14, once again, just the basic airframe had incredible flying qualities. Interesting enough, the F-14D included a infrared search and track, mm-hmm, IRST system, mm-hmm, which the Soviets, or I should say the Russians now, are very, very strong in this, because what it does is it detects the IR signature of airplanes and the infrared. And basically, if the airplane's flying at any kind of speed through the air, it's going to generate heat, mm-hmm, and it's going to show up and whatever. The F-14 had it. The newer airplanes so far, mm-hmm, have it. So F-14 had capabilities, and the other thing is that it was a big airplane, so it had a lot of volume in it. Mm-hmm. So as all these various missions came up and various capabilities and everything, they all fit in the airplane. It wasn't a matter of finding a place for them to go. Mm-hmm. So if I could do one thing to the F-14, resurrect it and make one change to it, is I would put a fly-by-wire flight control system in the airplane, mm-hmm, and it would have major, major benefits. But
yeah,
you know, we're talking pipe dreams.
Yeah. So So one thing I forgot to ask, an early thing, why is the F-14C missing out? Where did that go?
The which one?
The F-14C, it seems to be missing an upgrade there.
Oh, actually, way back when, in the initial part of the program, there was the F-14A, then the F-14B was a planned upgrade, which I believe was part of that was the 401 engine, and then there was a C that developed. So there was an initial plan. There was an A, a B, and a C. Mm-hmm. Well, that went by the boards very, very quickly. So the B eventually became an A with F-110 engines in it.
Mm-hmm.
And some other changes, but basically the F-110 in the A airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And then the D was the avionics, the radar upgrades, and the ejection seats were changed. There were significant changes mm-hmm. to the D.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where did the C go? That's a good question. It was there initially, but like everything else, it kind of just disappeared.
Yeah. So, is there anything else you would like to add before I go into some personal questions to wrap up this interview?
Well, I don't know. I think, basically, people always are curious about flight testing. I feel very, very fortunate because I had a chance to participate both on the Navy side and on the contractor side.
Mm-hmm.
And a good example of that would be in carrier suitability.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the Navy side, you get to go take a new design to the ship and determine how slow you can shoot it off the catapult.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a long process, but it's very, very interesting. And a lot of people aren't even aware of it. But when you get down to trying to determine what the minimum launch speed is, that they actually get to the point where to control the speed that the airplane sees as it goes off the catapult, they actually change the speed of the carrier.
Yeah.
To give it the correct speed. But anyways, when you determine that, then the fleet will never, ever be shot off within 5 knots of that.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, they'll give them 10 to 15 knots extra.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the responsibility of the Navy pilots. Mm-hmm. And then when you get on the contractor side, it's your responsibility to demonstrate that the airplane has the structural strength mm-hmm. to perform the carrier-based mission.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy, that everything is controlled aviation by Naval Air Systems Command, and they mm-hmm. write the requirements for demonstrating the airplane. And I think they're very sadistic people because they come up with things like, well, we have to verify that the structural loads are acceptable in accordance with what the spec is.
Mm-hmm.
The typical carrier landing, and most people I think are aware, Navy airplanes don't flare, they just fly a constant rate of descent to touchdown.
Mm-hmm.
Required to do that because of the precision required of where they touch down.
Mm-hmm.
So a typical on a fleet airplane is probably landing in the area of 12 or 13 feet per second,
mm-hmm.
which is fairly good descent rate. But the design requirement for the airplane to give it margin is over 25 feet per second.
Mm-hmm.
So when they determine these limits, there's no, unlike some of the others which have a 1.5 safety factor, the carrier suit design thing does not. So they give you the option of saying you can either demonstrate 25 feet per second once, or you can demonstrate 80% of it, but you have to do it 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, why do they make it 3 times? What do you learn after you've done the first one?
Mm-hmm.
And my personal belief is if you have to do it 3 times, they're hoping you're going to overshoot
mm-hmm.
and they'll get a higher sink rate landing.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, then they say, well, wait a minute. What happens if this would be for a normal landing. But what happens if he's nose down, he dumps the nose in a flat attitude? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, we'll make him demonstrate that. So now you got to do the high sink landings in a nose low attitude. But wait a minute, what happens if he pulls the nose up at the last minute and he's got a higher than normal? Yeah, we'll make him demonstrate that too. So in a nose high attitude or tail low attitude. And then you say, well, what if he was in a rolled attitude? What does that do? Oh yeah, we'll make him demonstrate that. He's got to land with 5 degrees of roll on the airplane. Okay, well, what happens if possibly he stepped on the rudder or something like that and the airplane is yawed? Yeah, that's a good idea. We'll make them demonstrate that. And then they said, but what if there's roll and yaw? Yeah, good idea. We'll have them demonstrate that too. And then they'll say, yeah, but what if roll is against the yaw? Oh, that's a good idea. We'll make them demonstrate that too. And it goes on and on. It yeah. becomes, it's interesting. And all this is done down in their facility at Pax River, where they have a shipboard arresting gear built into the runway. So all of these have to be done on arrested landing. So while all this stuff is going on, you got to once again land at the proper space so that the hook picks up the wire. So it's very, very interesting.
So I suppose it's hard to say, was it more difficult than Navy flying or fleet flying?
My answer is yes, because you're flying on a carrier approach. You are flying at a standard speed, and typically the carrier will work to eliminate any crosswind and what have you. And your approach speed, they handle the wind over deck to make sure you're within the engaging speed for the arresting gear. Well, on the beach, you can't control the wind. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to modify things based on what the wind is. You might be working with a crosswind, but the other thing is you're flying the airplane in a completely off speed. Mm-hmm. In other words, things that you're either fast or slow, and then you've got to achieve the proper required attitudes, which are all recorded on video. And of course you have to do this, and then they have to go back and look at it and say, yeah, you met the requirement or you didn't. So it's very challenging work.
So yeah, I can imagine, very stressful but very rewarding.
It is. And they, you know, basically what we did at Grumman is, if it was considered hazardous, extremely hazardous, we would not put a second person in the airplane. We would fly it just with the pilot. Mm-hmm. And so for the whole carrier suit program, I had what is known as an anthropomorphic dummy in my back seat, which was a life-size weight and what have you, and he had flight gear and mm-hmm. everything, but he rode around in the back seat. Mm-hmm. And from the outside, it looked like a normal guy in there, except he obviously didn't turn his head or look around.
People yeah.
always wondered. But, you know, basically, I think that's one of the things, is that I probably have more single seat time in the F-14 than anybody else had, just because of the length of the program. Okay, another important characteristic for any carrier-based airplane is range and endurance. Mm-hmm. And so basically, in the development of an airplane, in fact through the lifetime of an airplane, weapon systems change because the threat evolves, the technology available evolves, mm-hmm. and so weapon systems are updated. What's much more difficult to update in an airplane is the aerodynamics of the airplane, or the characteristics, as I would describe them, of the airframe. Mm-hmm. They're much more difficult. We had a recent example of the Navy on one of their, in fact, the F-14 replacement was was they were concerned about the limited range of the airplane. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, we can solve that. We will make a slight modification to the airplane and add more fuel. Mm-hmm. Well, when they did that, the airplane obviously got heavier. And so they said, gee, we've lost performance, maneuvering performance. So really, we have to redesign the wing and put a bigger wing on the airplane. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, okay, but now that you've got that, the performance of the airplane, we need more thrust. Mm-hmm. So then they looked and they said, sure, we can provide more thrust. However, the new engine is larger in diameter than the existing engine. Mm-hmm. So they had to redesign the fuselage in order to accept the new engine, and then they had to put new inlets on it to enable the airflow to it, and the new landing gear. Basically, by the time they got done, it's virtually a brand new airplane, although it was called a model change, date, if you will. And unfortunately, they really haven't solved the problem. So what I'd like to do is just take these considerations and look at the F-14 program as a whole. Basically, the first question a person has to ask is, did the airplane meet the threat? And I think unequivocally, the F-14 did in fact meet the threat that it was designed for. Did the airplane evolve during its lifetime to changes in the threat? And the answer to that is obviously yes, not only upgrades to the radar and what have you, but also the inclusion or the development of a very, very effective air-to-ground capability and photo capability. So, and then the next thing you have to ask about any given airplane, how long was it in service? And in case of the F-14, I think I calculated it's 36 years from the first flight of the airplane until the retirement. Mm-hmm. So that's a long span, particularly for a fighter.
Definitely. Yeah.
So basically, when the decision is made to retire the airplane, what drives that decision? One consideration could be that it no longer meets the threat. It no longer meets the requirements. I don't think anybody would dispute that that didn't apply to the F-14. Mm-hmm. The next thing is there was a better option available, another airplane that could do it, do the same mission or better, and at a more economical cost. I think that has been put to bed as far as the F-14 goes. And then the one that has control over is the airplane could be retired because of the political environment. That some politician somewhere decides that they're no longer going to produce that airplane. They're going with another one. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what the operators of the airplane, in this case the U.S. Navy, wants. It doesn't matter. The politicians know better. So basically, I want to point out with the F-14, the thing that amazed me is the last airplane that we produced on the line looked remarkably like the first.
It did, yeah.
I'm addressing not necessarily the weapon system. I'm addressing the airframe and what have you. The major change were bigger engines, but as we've discussed, that was part of the original plan for the airplane. Mm-hmm. So really, the last airplane we produced looked remarkably like the first one. So if you add all this stuff up, I think I can very confidently say the F-14 product the Navy's ever had.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a pleasure, but do you mind if I ask you some more personal questions so we can get a personal side of you?
Sure.
So do you have any hobbies?
Go ahead. Yeah, we live in the Northwest, and it's the ideal spot for boating up here. So we're into that. We have the opportunity here to take advantage of Mother Nature. We have crabbing and prawning and fishing and cruising and what have you. So boating is a primary occupation for us now. Recreation-wise.
Sounds very tranquil.
And then occasionally I get technically challenged, like someone asked me to use Skype, which I have no idea.
Yeah, you can blame me for that. So, is there an aircraft you wish you could have flown or tested?
You know, everybody has a favorite airplane. The Crusader, which was my first fleet airplane, I always loved that airplane. There is a good example of an airplane that was very, very demanding to land on the carrier. But the fighter pilots were more than willing to accept that challenge to get the performance that the airplane offered. And of course, I spent so much time with the F-14, and I don't have any loyalty left for any other airplane.
I can imagine, yeah.
So, between those two, we had Grumman participated. We built, designed, and built a technology demonstrator, the X-29, which is a forward swept wing airplane. And I had the pleasure of being the project pilot on that. And it was very, very challenging, interesting, and a great experience. So I guess through my association between the Navy and Grumman, there's not another plane out there that I said, gee, I wish I could have flown that one.
I'm going to ask you a question from one of our viewers. How did the F-14 compare to the F-15?
Well, the Air Force, when they designed the F-15, they had one design requirement, and that was to optimize it as a fighter. I'm talking about the initial design for the F-15.
Yeah.
The Navy, as we've discussed on the F-14, had other requirements, the fleet air defense, the long range, the big missiles, and everything else. So initially, the thrust to weight, which is always an important thing in a fighter, advantage really went to the F-15. So basically, until the F-110 arrived in the F-14, and I would say that a proficient F-14 guy would not be intimidated at all by the F-15. The F-15 is a fine airplane, but that initial advantage of a much better thrust-to-weight ratio went away once we got the F-110.
Do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
No, there's a great story about a woman on a date, a blind date with a fighter pilot, and so at over their meal, as he incessantly talked about himself, about what he did, how great he was. And she was about at the end of her chain when he said, well, enough about me. Let's talk about airplanes.
Oh, I like that. That's a good one.
So I'm probably guilty of that. And hopefully I'm not guilty of the initial part of that. I have a great appreciation for the quality of people that I had the pleasure to work with through my whole career. And it made everything challenging, fun, and in my mind, relatively safe. So I just feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity.
Well, Kurt, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor, because from your career history, you've definitely got some tales to tell. And the F-14 is my favorite plane, as all my viewers will know. So I just want to thank you for joining us on the show.
Well, I appreciate your interest. And I think, you know, any time I can help you out or answer any of your questions, you know, we can talk on Skype.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, you can watch and listen to all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, please sign up to our newsletter for exclusive content, prizes, upcoming interviews, and much more. And of course, go over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us grow and to become part of the team for as little as $1 per month. Thank you, and see you soon.